All right, and welcome to Red Reviews number 11. I guess before we get started, I want to say thank you to everybody who watches this, and to make sure if you like what we're doing here, share it, subscribe, comment, all that stuff. Make sure people know we're here and that we're doing something.
Yeah, smash that like button, bro.
I cannot make myself say that.
you smash that like button, hit subscribe, make sure to hit the notification bell so you know you're getting all the videos. I watch enough shit. And yeah, definitely I encourage people to be patrons. I'm a patron myself. I'm going to probably, once I kind of figure it out, I'm going to try to up what I do every month on my Patreon for you.
So, oh, well, thank you.
I don't really support any other Patreon accounts anymore, mainly just because the ones that I did support are kind of rather, no offense to them, but they're kind of rather large ones.
They don't
need it. Like, and one of them I don't actually even listen to anymore. So I highly encourage people to become patrons for sure.
Yeah, I think it, I mean, not to promote this too much, but I think it's important to support shows or content creators who will make a difference in their day-to-day lives.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Not that the big creators, like if everybody quit their supporting them, then suddenly, and to go to smaller creators, then they would be in dire straits. So
don't necessarily do that, you know, but just be, but basically, no, I mean, I had to kind of reconfigure some stuff mainly just because I bought a car.
Right.
So I have a car payment again now. And so I had to kind of figure out, okay, what can I cut back in every month and so on. Bills just keep going up. It sucks. Yeah. But
That never changes.
Nope. That is the universal law of life for sure. So.
Okay.
So, for sure. This is the great, perfect show to talk about it. So, tonight's book is called The Origin of Capitalism, A Longer View.
Cool.
By Ellen Meekson's Wood. It was published about 20 years ago. It was originally a series of monthly review articles. So for those who don't know, Monthly Review is a very sort of celebrated, long-running socialist periodical. I think it has ties to the New Left movement in the 1960s. So she wrote a series of articles in Monthly Review, and then they were turned into a book. The newest edition was published in 2017. She was professor of political economy or political history at, York University, political science at York University in Toronto.
Okay.
So she's a fellow Canadian. Nice. And she passed away in 2016 at the age of 73. Her book is a very short but very important book in sort of the history of modern left scholarship, in that it is one of the books that is kind of revolutionizing the sort of scholarly field, or sort of left a big effect on the scholarly field of the sort of transitional studies. So, you know, how did capitalism become capitalism, right? So this is sort of a perennial question that scholars for decades, if not centuries, have sort of tried to figure out, how did capitalism become capitalism? And so this is her view of it based on not her own, only her own research, but on the research of others, particularly a guy named Robert Brenner.
Okay.
And her book fits broadly into what's called the Brenner debate. So to kind of get us started, so the sort of the book starts with the traditional notion of how we think of the origin of capitalism, right? So generally, what most people think is of, and sort of a broader view of what, how capitalism became what it was and what it is something she calls the commercialization model.
Okay.
And this is something that goes back even to Adam Smith. It goes back to other writers like Max Weber, and then, of course, Karl Marx himself, because Marx heavily relied upon and learned from the works of Adam Smith and then another political economist named David Ricardo. So what is the commercialization model? So to give you a sort of a Cliff Notes version of it, the commercialization model essentially argues that the growth of urban areas – so cities, the growth of cities, mixed with the growing sophistication of financial instruments and the growth of trade, all of those things kind of hit a tipping point that went from sort of pre-capitalist or sort of proto-capitalist societies that had some level of commodification, financialization, and so on, to become capitalist in the sense that it had commodities that were traded for surplus value, right? Now, the main issue with the sort of commercialization model, at least in Woods's estimation, is that it does not take into account the fact that capitalism is not something that is natural. So one of the things that one of the sort of the byproducts of the commercialization model, which is even within Marx's own work, according to Wood, is this idea that sort of capitalism naturally arose out of these specific conditions. So you have the rise of cities, you have the rise of financialization, you have the rise of trade and the rise of commodity production, and all of those kind of come together and they make capitalism.
Okay.
Her argument is that what really happened, the reason capitalism happened, is not so much because of a sort of natural development of commercialized forces, but rather specific historical events that were predicated upon specific social relations. So to break it down, basically, okay, the traditional view is more sort of rooted in objective factors, whether it's like specific financial instruments or specific trade agreements and specific commodity production. Whereas hers is a much more sort of like, not say subjective view, but in some senses it is, in the sense that it's actually based on contingent historical forces. Okay. And so that's kind of the overview of the commercialization model. Now, my opinion is that the problem with the whole Brenner debate, because she's a part of it, right, breaks down into those two camps, whether or not certain things just sort of developed over time and then eventually became capitalism, or that capitalism was specifically developed based on specific historical circumstances that were based on specific social relations that changed. And my thinking on the subject is, why are we making the delineation?
Yeah, why is there a dichotomy there?
And the reason that she says there is a dichotomy is basically because if you look at sort of proto-capitalist societies, whether it's and she cites like the medieval Florence and the Dutch Republic as sort of examples of proto-capitalist societies. Okay. So Florence is very important in sort of the development of sort of modern economic systems, in the sense that especially Florence is where modern instruments of financialization are developed. I think it's in Florence where dual entry accounting is developed. So dual entry accounting is super important. Everybody knows it and uses it regardless of whether they know it's what it's called. So basically, right, what dual entry accounting is it shows you everything that's going in, that's coming in, and everything that's going out on the one ledger.
Yeah, and it's the exact way you budget.
It's exactly the way you budget. Yeah. That's what dual entry accounting is, right? And so the Florentines really developed this during the Renaissance. Now, again, the Renaissance is a pre-capitalist society.
Right.
And so the reason that she makes a specific delineation is because her argument is there's an enormous difference between commerce and capitalism. And those are two different things.
Right, right.
And so the reason that she says that they're different is because you can have a society with money. You can have a society with markets. You can have a society with trade.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's capitalist.
Right.
What makes it capitalist? And for her, what makes it capitalist is the appropriation of a worker surplus labor with, you know, in a market system. So that extraction of surplus value out of commodity production, that is capitalism. That is it, right? And, you know, that kind of goes back to our earlier episode when we talked about Richard Wolff and Democracy at Work. Right. His idea is pretty much the same thing, which is that capitalism is really defined by who creates the surplus and who gets it.
Yeah, that really seems like the kind of the core of socialism, right? Like, I guess maybe it's not common knowledge, but lots of people who are socialists think we can have markets, like you say, or like,
yep,
you know, we talk about running a business and the workers owning the money or getting the money from the sales or whatever, the production. So, yep. You know, that's not capitalism, but it's still money, markets, commerce, like you say. So
exactly, right? And so some would argue that sort of the PRC today, the People's Republic of China, is a market socialist system where it's there's an incredible amount of like private enterprise and markets and price mechanisms and wage labor and commodification, but there's also an incredible amount of economic planning and central authority and state-owned enterprise. And those that hybrid together, right? So in China, they sort of just refer to that as market socialism, at least the CPC does, the Communist Party. In Europe, you might call that the sort of the Sweden model, where it's this kind of hybrid form where you do have some state enterprise, but you still have markets, right?
Yeah.
So that's her whole point. And her whole argument is that if you look at medieval Florence, not medieval Florence, but like Renaissance Florence, where you look at the early Dutch Republic, right? Because the early Dutch Republic is set up as one of the sort of big progenitors of modern capitalism. In earlier writings that I've read about, you know, the rise of sort of the Enlightenment and the rise of capitalist societies, the Dutch Republic is one that fits into it because the Dutch Republic was not only economically liberalized in the sense that it had markets, it had trade, it had commodities production, but it also had a certain level of political freedom that other places didn't have. So, for example, in early Puritans who, before they came to the United States, a lot of them had lived in the Dutch Republic. They were sort of exiles in the Dutch Republic because the Dutch society, which is now the Netherlands, for those who don't know, had a certain level of religious liberty that England did not have. And so to get back on it, so basically her argument is, if you look at those societies, they have all these things that we think of as being sort of capitalist, right? But they don't become capitalist societies until much later on, right? But England does. Right. So you have all of these countries that have all of the sort of hallmarks of different components that we would think of as being capitalism, but they don't become capitalist, you know? Like early 19th century France after the revolution, not a capitalist revolution. It was a bourgeois one, but it was not a capitalist revolution in that sense. And so with that in mind, how did capitalism come? Right. How did it come to be? And so this is where you get into her major thesis, which is still controversial, and there's still heated debates about this to this day. And, you know, we can certainly hash out whether we think it's right or not. But it's based on the work of Robert Brenner. Robert Brenner was, I think, a political economist. He wrote an incredibly influential article called Agrarian Class Structure and Economic Development in Pre-Industrial Europe. Her argument rests on his work.
Okay.
And sort of she takes what he's done and goes further. And so what is the major thesis of that, of Wood and Bremer? Okay. What it is, or Brenner rather, is that what actually developed capitalism, because England really was the birthplace of capitalism, kind of in their understanding and the way that we think of capitalism in terms of commodity production, surplus value, That is all really based in England. Well, why does that happen? It happens because of specific social relations which are developed through the agricultural sector of the society. And so this ties into Enlightenment philosophy, specifically John Locke. And so philosophers of the time, you know, people like Thomas More, who wrote Utopia, or people like Sir John Davies or William Petty. Mm-hmm. And the central argument is that when you have land held in common, it is not being utilized to its full potential. And so the best way to utilize it is to privatize it. And so it's the development of the destruction of the commons.
Right, right.
What is called primitive accumulation by Marx. Or, as David Harvey would call it, accumulation by dispossession. So basically what it is it's that specific philosophers make the argument that we need to privatize the land for agricultural purposes. When this happens, you have some farmers who get to own their land and then sell their commodities off in a marketplace. They're sort of petty bourgeois, right? Self-proprietors.
Right, right.
But then you also have farmers who used to be a part of the sort of common system under either feudalism who don't make enough money to own their own land.
So
they have to work for a wage. And so this develops decades before people are working specifically in factories making commodities.
Right.
The original commodity itself was agriculture.
Of course.
And this is the big, I think, philosophical difference between Wood and a lot of the traditional reads of it, is a lot of people think that the development of capitalism was a specifically urban phenomenon. And her argument and Brenner's argument flips it on its head and says, actually, no, capitalism developed specifically because of agriculture and the way that agriculture was completely reorganized. Right. At the beginning of the 18th century and into the 19th. So I think that's a fairly compelling thesis. I think the big issue with it is that, like, again, like, it's kind of an either or thing. It's like, why are we making these kind of distinctions?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think like that makes perfect sense. Once you have private property, that's when you start having capitalism, right?
Yep.
But then, there's no reason to say that the development of capitalism as a system stopped there. And, you know, and that obviously it continued into the Industrial Revolution and all of this other stuff.
Yeah. And And the thing is that as the populations grew, you had to find ways to have them have work. Because before you had the common land system, you know, in feudalism, it would kind of work like this. So let's say you worked on land. It was held in common. You would make enough. You would produce enough that the feudal lord would want. You would give that off to the authorities. And then whatever else you made, you got to keep. So there wasn't right. You were not in the sort of position of owner and worker. You were much more in the position of serf and lord, right? Again, right. It's still a power imbalance, but it's set up completely different because the lord and serf dynamic is almost completely divorced from our modern notions of political economy. Like, there's no prices. Like, there's not the kind of like mechanisms that we would think of, right? The notion of surplus value doesn't really exist. But once you get into the modern era and the sort of the commodification of agriculture, that's really when everything starts to change. And so that's kind of the central argument that she makes within the book. And one of the things that I found particularly interesting in the book is that one of the common notions that we often read is that the rise of the Enlightenment, you know, this era of, you know, questioning authority and, you know, studying things scientifically and using reason, we associate that with the growth of capitalism. Those two things go hand in hand. And that's how I've always read them. You know, there's a lot of great books on the Enlightenment, whether it's, you know, Ray Porter's book, you know, I forget exactly what it's called. It's a great book, though. Ray Porter's book. I think it's on the back of my shelf. What's it called? Yeah. The Creation of the Modern World.
Okay.
You know, Peter Gay's 2-volume History of the Enlightenment, you know, and then obviously like more sort of like mainstream people like Steven Pinker makes this argument.
Right.
Like all of the sort of modern atheists in mainstream discourse make this argument that capitalism and enlightenment go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And that the one needed the other.
And to be anti-capitalist is to throw away all of the advancements of the Enlightenment.
Exactly. Right. Wood challenges this notion directly and says that if you really look at the areas in which the Enlightenment flourished, specifically 18th century France, it didn't go capitalist.
Right.
It just didn't. Right. So when you think of the French Revolution, 1789, as I mentioned earlier, that was a bourgeois revolution in the sense that you had, you know, sort of an elite class who was a sort of mercantile class who did make their money by trading and selling things. But they weren't necessarily capitalists in the sense that they owned the means of production and then extracted surplus value. They made their money, but the phrase she uses a lot, by, you know, buying cheap and selling dear, basically selling at a profit, you know. And Wood basically makes the distinction that, like, if you buy things and you sell them for the profit as a merchant, that doesn't necessarily make you a capitalist in the sense that, because you don't own the means of production and you're not extracting surplus value.
You're not buying labor and then extracting the value that it creates. You're buying products and then selling them.
Exactly, right? And so if you look at France at the Russian and the French Revolution, it's not a capitalist revolution. You know, if you look at the United States, you know, the only revolution of that era which you could make an argument is a capitalist one is the United States. It's kind of really the only one in the sense that the United States did, but even then, right? So it's 1776. It's, you know, it's 12 years or 13 years before the French Revolution. You could again make the argument that the American Revolution was also a bourgeois revolution and not a capitalist one.
Right.
And so, because again, most people in 1776 did not have capital. They didn't own the means of production and they weren't developing a surplus value. They were not extracting surplus value from workers.
Right.
Most people were either farmers, independent farmers who owned their land and made their own goods and then sold their goods, or they were merchants, or they were tied to the sort of educated elite, whether they were sort of or they were involved in the slave trade, right?
Right.
So I
could see an argument saying like that the slave trade was an example of early capitalism because of the extraction of labor and, you know, extraction.
And I think this is where there are holes in her argument, because I do think that's right. Like, and I think the other issue too is that, like, the problem I think with her thesis is that her whole thing is that capitalism is this very specific thing, and that I'm going to review history to see where it matches this very specific definition that I've made.
Yeah. So,
maybe, to use it. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just saying, maybe the methodology she's using is maybe a little bit, you know, problematic.
Yes. Because even if something is not, it's like explicitly capitalist, right? Then, but it has a lot of the hallmarks of capitalism, whether it's merchants, trade, commodities, prices, money, you know, wages, like all of those things are kind of important and they do kind of exist, right?
Yeah.
So
how much of what we call, you know, factors of capitalism, how many are necessary and where is the line where it crosses, right?
Yeah. And I think for me, I look at it very much like evolution, right? So, you know, we didn't go from,
right.
You know, Homo erectus to boom, we were just Homo sapiens. Like, that just didn't happen. It was a gradual
transitional species.
There were transitions to that, right? And each little changed things over time. This is the Hegelian point we've talked about before, the change of quantity into quality, where a certain quantity changes enough over time that it qualitatively changes something. And that's, I think, how capitalism is too. And so my argument and what I would say is that, like, I don't think Wood is necessarily wrong, but, like, I think it negates the fact that capitalism also developed as a result of specific property relations that weren't explicit to agriculture, but they started with agriculture, and that's kind of what her argument hinges on.
Okay.
And the other thing I think it's interesting is, but basically, like, her whole thing is that this popular notion that the Enlightenment brought capitalism is not necessarily true. They just sort of kind of happened at the same time, and so people kind of put the two together. And her argument is, if you look at 18th century France, it's not capitalist. If you look at 18th century America, it has some capitalist stuff in it, or proto-capitalist, but it's not really capitalist, right? Capitalism is a very specific mode of production, which largely develops in the early to mid 19th century in England. It's a very, you know, it's a very specific place, and then it spreads out everywhere else. And so I think the thing with the argument is it's kind of like what we said. It's like, at what point do you cut off? At what point do you make your, like, at what point do you, you say, okay, this is capitalism,
right,
and move on. I think the big problem with this is that I think it's fine. Like, I think it's important to make the argument that that, you know, commodity production in agriculture is the main thing that really helped start capitalism because it reset the social relations. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important. I think the really big lesson to take away from her, which is, I think, very much a component of Marxist thought, because Wood was a Marxist, although she was not like a revolutionary Marxist. She was not a Marxist-Leninist. She does not sort of come out of the same tendency that, say, like I do.
Right.
And critics of her, you know, particularly somebody like Louis Proyect, from Colombia, he is a revolutionary Marxist. So he critiques her from that perspective.
Okay.
He wrote a long article sort of critiquing her called The Brenner Thesis as Iberientalism, which is a word that he made up to describe Brenner and Woods's obsession with Spain, because Spain is another one, right? I kind of glossed over that, but a component of the book and in Brenner's ideas is Spain. So like Spain has this large empire. It has trade routes. It has markets, but doesn't really become capitalist, you know? And, right. but it kind of does. I mean, like, that's kind of the problem, is that, like, you know, if you define capitalism by solely ownership of the means of production and surplus value, then yeah, it's like, but I think capitalism is broader than that. Like, I think, like, and it kind of becomes like a chicken and the egg thing where it's like, what came first, like private property or commodification of private property, commerce versus private, like all of those go hand in hand. Like the reason that they had to reset the property relationships was because they had to develop agriculture as a commodity because it was being traded in a marketplace. Because people were trading it, right?
Right.
If people were not selling things and trying to ship them halfway across the world, you wouldn't need to make commodities. There'd be no need for that, right?
Yeah.
In this, because people could be independent proprietors or independent farmers. So, like, in my opinion, like, I think her thesis is right, but it tells only part of the story.
Right.
I think the commercialization model is not wrong. She thinks it's wrong and I don't. Like, I think that, like, the development of trade and money and financialization, all those are important because they're the mechanisms by which, capitalism develops. And contrary to the kind of the way she reads it, is that these things were also very socially developed. Like, they're not natural. I think, and that's a good criticism that she makes, which is that people see the development of capitalism as being this kind of natural thing when actually it's really built on historically contingent social relations.
Right.
That's true.
Like, all, it's always people in power who need to be pushing it forward in order to, you know, benefit themselves in some way.
Exactly. Right. So how do you make accounting easier? You develop a specific version of it called dual entry accounting. That's not something that came out of nature. That's something that somebody developed over time based on historically contingent social relations. So like, that's kind of the issue, is that, like, you could apply the sort of like historical lens that she comes up with and Brenner comes up with. You could apply it to the other things that they don't think are as important. You know, like, trade routes are not natural. They come up out of specific social relations. So like, the biggest issue as I have is that, like, it's the sort of, you know, if you're doing improv with your friends, like, it's instead of an either or, it's a yes and. Yeah. In a sense that, like, yes, you're right about agriculture. Yes, you're right about these specific property relationships developed based on very historically contingent events. But all these other things are like that too. And so, you know,
we have a comment. It says, hey, sorry.
Oh, we do.
Just curious who you're talking about.
I forgot we were on Twitch.
So we're talking, I can't remember the name of the author again. We're talking about
Ellen
the book,
Nixon's The Origins. The Origin of Capitalism, A Longer View by Ellen Meekson's Wood.
Yeah.
Is the book. And so Louis Proyect, who's a sort of revolutionary Marxist who critiqued her work and Brenner's work, makes the argument that, you know, from the standpoint of class relations, and he's talking about, like, you know, contemporary South Africa and colonial Spain have much in common. Capitalism is not about advanced technology. I think that's true. Until relatively recent times, a miner worked with a pick and a shovel. Nor is capitalism about freedom. It is about producing surplus value. If a workforce is not available to work for a wage, then the capitalist state will pass laws ensuring that various forms of unfree labor keep the system going, which reaffirms the point you just made about slavery. So, you know, in many ways, the United States actually was a lot more capitalist than, say, 18th century France, specifically because they were extracting surplus value out of slaves in a way that maybe France wasn't, right? It is our job as Marxists to develop a class analysis that can maximize the power of the laboring classes politically, quibbling over whether the worker is really a worker or not, based on the peculiarities of a given country's history, not only constitutes a form of pedantic quibbling, it is a detour from our tasks as revolutionaries. And I think this is a really important point that why the, and this goes to the broader limitations of sort of New Left thought.
Right.
New Left thought largely rejects a lot of the revolutionary Marxism of the 20th century. It rejects, you know, it rejects Lenin, it rejects Mao. It rejects the sort of the need for a revolutionary break. And instead, it argues this sort of new ground in which we can sort of work in, wherein we don't challenge capitalism, we make our peace with it. And that's kind of the bigger problem that I have with writers like her, people like Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe, a lot of these post-Marxist writers who think that, well, you know, a lot of that Marxist or Leninist stuff, it's a little old hat. Maybe we need to give it like a new go and try to figure something else out. It's like, my argument is actually no. Like, this stuff is very important. And if you want to look at revolutions that have been successful all around the world, which model do they use? They use the Leninist one. And so, like, now some are different, right? Because we've talked before about like Rahava and whatever. But generally, like, if you look at large scale revolutions, the Russian Revolution, Chinese Revolution, the Cuban Revolution, Vietnam, North Korea, they all use broadly the Marxist-Leninist model.
So
my problem with this book is generally that it's like, it is this kind of like pissing contest and trying to figure out like, you know, where did it really begin? It's like, well, it's a bunch of all of these things going all at once, and they all sort of develop by specific choices based on specific social relations, but it's not either or, it's all of the above.
Yeah, like I seem to be getting the impression that it is an important part of the whole picture if we're trying to get a big, you know, actual full picture of everything, but it is incomplete on its own.
I agree. I think that it's in general, like, it's important to understand some of these historically relevant pieces, but ultimately, will this help people get better wages?
Right.
Will this help people really break with capitalism? And my answer is no. I mean, it ultimately...
Unlikely.
Because here's the thing. I go back to what Big Bill Haywood said once. And I don't want to sound anti-intellectual here. That's not my intent. My intent is really to just show the limitations of sort of modern, you know, non-revolutionary Marxist thought. You know, and sort of show that, you know, in my opinion, like, that revolutionary Marxists are more right. This is something we're going to get into next time when we discuss David Harvey's book, A Brief History of Neoliberalism, because again, he's also a non-revolutionary Marxist, and we're going to critique some of his work as well.
Okay.
I didn't mean for this to be the theme of the next couple episodes. It just sort of happened based on what I was reading. But
interestingly enough, the episode of the interview portion of this episode that is coming out in a couple days is with Democratic Socialists of Canada. So they're kind of the non-revolutionary type leftists. So
okay,
it's an interesting interview, and but also you can see where the break in opinion is, right?
For sure. I mean, because you and I come from different tendencies, but we agree on the necessity of revolution. I mean, I think this is the larger point that we both agree on. Now, how exactly that's going to take form, we don't necessarily know.
Right.
But we believe genuinely in a break because, you know, capitalism, as we figured out, is if you don't make a clean break with it, it's just going to constantly reform and become this its own thing. And it's like a blob. You know, it moves and it shapes based on wherever it needs to be. It doesn't have the kind of like hard rules that other systems do. So, yeah, I mean, I think that in general, I think this is a good book. I think people should read it. I think it's very interesting. I do think the fact that it puts an emphasis on agriculture, which is very important. A lot of traditional readings of the rise of capitalism don't talk about agriculture. So I think that's actually really important that, like, what is one of the really important components of the development of capitalism? It is private property. And why were they, why did private property develop? It developed because people needed to privatize land. Because they were not extracting a surplus value out of the land under the sort of common system or under the feudal system. So that's super important. But there's other components to it as well. And that's kind of where I'm at. It's a good book. I think that it's contentious. I think that it's not settled in the sense that, like, this is the be all end all, you know.
Right, right.
You know. That's why it's always tricky when you name your book like the something, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, biographers who often write, you know, books on historical figures. What?
Well, you really got to have it pretty solid if you're going to call it the thing, right?
The thing. Yes, exactly. Right. And the issue with this is that, you know, instead of calling it a longer view, she really should have called her book The Origin of Capitalism, a Contrary View. Because, like, that's really what the book is. It's here's the traditional model we think of. Here's my view of it, which is contrary to this. And that's really it. I mean, I think that's the more specific and more accurate title. But it's a good book. I mean, I enjoyed reading it. It's very clear and well written. It's short, you know, it's like 200 pages, but it does read kind of like a PhD monograph. It's very, very dense. It's short, okay, but it's dense.
Right.
And I highly encourage people to check it out and to, you know, read follow up material on it, and sort of read about the controversies around the sort of what's broadly called the Brenner debate. Because this is a book that's sort of the seminal book on one side of that debate. And, you know, and so, yeah, I encourage people to check it out. Regardless, I think to take away for us as sort of revolutionary socialists is it's like, it's very important that we learn our history, we learn theory, and that's why I do this show with you. But at the same time, it's also important to acknowledge that, like, there's a point in which you need to start developing real actions and do things. And, the sort of quibbling is fine, but acknowledge that it's an academic exercise.
Right, right.
And don't get too hopped up on it, because ultimately it's just going to lead you down a sort of like self-ingratiating, you know, lane where you're just going to feel good about yourself. Basically, I wanted to kind of end this with one of my favorite quotes, which is from Big Bill Haywood, one of the founders of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW. And he said that, he once said that, "I've never read Marx's Capital, but I've got the Marx of Capital all over me." And so I know a lot about it. It's like, yeah, that's true. You learn also by experience. And I think that's important to note too.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a good book. It's, I would give it 4 stars out of 5, sure. 3.5, 4 out of 5. But I think it's not the end of the argument. I think it's one component of the argument.
Yeah. At the risk of, going a little longer, we've got a
please.
Comment. I think non-sequently, I'm not sure about the name. I might have said it wrong. I think something that has caught me up about the idea of revolution is that thinking of the majority of the U.S., many folks aren't really prepared for revolution. They're really dependent on the existing capitalist structure. And I think that's accurate. I think that's a fair statement. People... We're all very dependent on it.
Yep.
I am a pro revolution person, or a pro, you know, breaking the system to get, like, I don't know how that's going to work, but I'm also very worried about how my family is going to survive when or if this happens. So, you know, there's a balance there. I guess we all have to acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
But okay.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. And I agree with you. I mean, like, you know, it's like as Mao said, you know, revolution is not a birthday party.
Right.
You know, it is truly a overthrow of a system to create another using violent means. I mean, because the thing is that My argument would be the way that you build for revolution is by developing institutions that are explicitly organized and strategically developed for revolution. So, for example, like I'm affiliated with the Party for Socialism and Liberation, the PSL. We are an explicitly Marxist-Leninist party. We are revolutionary Marxists, right? We believe that the working class needs to be as disciplined and as professional and as strategic as the ruling class, because that's how they've gotten where they are, right? Mm. It's a class war and we're losing it. And so, in my opinion, the way that you get towards revolution is by building institutions that are outside of the state that exist to foment and develop the revolutionary energies that are required and to become, you know, because I am a Marxist-Leninist. So like you have a revolutionary vanguard, a vanguard party that exists to animate and educate the working class to foment that revolution, right? And so like so it's not a perfect view, but like that's the only way it's ever worked. Like
that sounds very similar to like ideas from anarchists about building dual power, basically.
Yep.
Like you build a system outside of this existing system. You build, you know, mutual aid networks. You build groups that go out and repair roads. Like you just do shit that is not reliant on the current system, and it becomes a major threat to the existing system because you're already building this stuff and you don't rely on it.
Exactly. And I think one of the ways is thinking about reforms, right? So like revolutionary Marxists are not necessarily, well, I don't want to paint with a broad brush, but like I'll say from my own opinion that like reforms are not necessarily a bad thing. Like if you can get a higher minimum wage, that's great. If you can get better workplace protection, that's great. Yeah. If you can get universal healthcare, that's great. Like I'm not saying that's bad, but that can't be the be all end all. We're not going to achieve socialism merely by just reformism. You're not going to achieve. So that's kind of the Kautsky model, right? So Karl Kautsky, the leader of the Second International, the sort of intellectual leader of the Marxist movement directly preceding Lenin, that's what he believed, that if you elected enough people and you got them in power and they started to do reforms, over time, you would do enough of those reforms that you would basically build socialism from within. And ultimately, the problem with doing that is that the system wherein you can build socialism is also built and designed by the capitalists. So it can, for every reform it can give you, it can also take it away. Yeah. And if you need any indication of that, just look at the last four decades of neoliberalism and the complete rolling back of the social safety net, not just the United States and Canada, but around the world. And that's something we'll talk about next time when we talk about David Harvey's book.
Nice. Okay. So we're going to wind it down here. Where can people find your other content?
So people can find me at Justin Clark PH on Instagram. It's really the only social media I use. I post book reviews there and other stuff. You can also find me at justinclark.org. That's my website that has a lot of my writing on it. And some of my professional work. And then I'll do a quick pitch for PSL if you're interested in learning more about the Party for Socialism and Liberation. I highly encourage people to check out their website, pslweb.org.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Justin. And thank you to the two people that
That's awesome.
Watched us this whole time.
That's awesome. It's the ones and twos, you know. It's as Lenin, you know, said, you know, it's better, fewer, but better.
There you go.
You know, so it's always good.
Awesome. All right. Have a good one.
Thank you. You too, man.
All right. That's all, folks. Thanks for watching and or listening. Remember to share this show with your friends and on the social media site that you use the most. I want to say thank you again to everyone who supports the show on Patreon. It's really appreciated and it helps me spend more time on this and my other projects when I'm not at work so that I don't have to work as many gig hours. If you want to contribute, you can do that at patreon.com/skepticalleftist, or you can buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/skepticallefty. If you can't contribute financially, then a 5-star rating and a review on your podcast app of choice or one of the podcast review sites like Podchaser would be great. If you want to find more from me, then you can check out the show notes or check my link tree. That's linktr.ee/skepticalcorey. You can find all my social media stuff there, as well as links to my other shows, which include Skeptarchy, which is a panel show I do with some very smart people, For Many People's Strength, which is a show about Saskatchewan politics, and a new project I'm involved in that's called The Atheist Humanist Leftist Revolutionaries with my friend Damien Marie at Hope. My Twitter is at Skeptical Lefty, and my Facebook page is The Mind of a Skeptical Leftist. Or you can send me a friend request, which is facebook.com/CJBrainstorm. I accept most friend requests. You can also email me at mindofaskepticalleftist@gmail.com. And if you want to be a guest on the show or know someone I should reach out to, then feel free to let me know. You can book interviews in my available time slots on my Calendly, which you can find on my link tree. Thanks so much for listening, and let's just all try to be kind to other leftists and to all people, and even if we think they're wrong. The battle that we are fighting is an uphill one and has many obstacles, and we will need all the comrades we can get.